From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As we reported earlier, Vitaly Churkin, the permanent representative of the Russian Federation to the United Nations, passed away Tuesday at the age of 64. Churkin was Russia's representative at the UN for more than a decade, a period that saw big changes in the relationship between the U.S. and Russian Federation. In this, reputed to be his last interview with RT's Alexei Yaroshevsky, he detailed some of the problems that exist between the U.S. and Russia, the hope offered by the structure that exists at the UN Security Council, and the job of being a diplomat.
February 10th is the day of the diplomat in Russia. What do you think? How has this profession changed over the years? And how stressful it is to be a diplomat in these days?
Well, I don't know. I think it has become much more hectic than it used to be in the past. And it is stressful. And unfortunately, the world has not become more stable than it used to be. And there are quite a few hotspots where diplomats are posted. So the increasing political tension and increasing challenges are coupled with the lack of stability. So quite a few of my colleagues find themselves working in rather stressful and difficult circumstances.
But how do diplomats cope with all this stress? I mean,
they just go about their jobs. They're trying to do their best. And I think we are very privileged in our foreign ministry to have very good, dedicated professionals. So I think, by and large, we are doing well, speaking about our diplomatic service.
Ambassador, speaking of diplomats, you are a seasoned diplomat with a career spanning decades. Now we have the new U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, who has never been a diplomat. She was a governor. And how do you think this will affect her job at such a high position as a UN
ambassador? Well, we'll see. Of course, she's coming to the United Nations with a lot of political experience. She is clearly a very capable and gifted person. I had a very good meeting with her a couple of days ago, and she's sort of self-confident and knows what she's trying to achieve. You know, there are political appointees in every system. Maybe in the United States they have more political appointees than we have, or in some other countries. But some of them are doing very good jobs, and I think what she's going to be helped by in her work in the United Nations is that he is going to be also a member of the President Trump's candidate cabinet. She's going to be a member of the National Security Council, Committee of the Principals, etc., etc. Well, on the other hand, I think it's going to add more stresses to what she is supposed to do. Incidentally, the same was the case with her two predecessors, both Ambassador Power and Ambassador Rice. We're combining their jobs in New York with their positions in Washington. So definitely she's going to be a very well-informed and well-positioned colleague. But it will also be distracting some of her attention from what is going to happen in New York.
But I know it's very early to say about, you know, the depth of experience of you communicating with her, but clearly Ambassador Power, Ambassador Rice that you just mentioned, you've had some really intense exchanges with them over the years. What about Nikki Haley? Is she a different breed?
Well, it's too early to tell. As I say, we had a very nice conversation with her bilaterally. We talked about all sorts of things. She seems to be open-minded and friendly. Without revealing any particular secrets, we agreed that she agreed with me when I said that confidence, trust among diplomats is very important, and I intend to behave in a very open and frank way with her. I expect the same kind of thing from her, and she agreed that this is the attitude which we need to apply as two diplomats who by fate are entrusted with those very important jobs in the Security Council, because, and she understands that, without our intensive interaction, the Security Council as a collective executive body, which has very heavy responsibilities in terms of international peace and security, simply will not be able to function. So in addition to the things we need to do as representatives of our countries, pursuing both our national agendas on the Security Council, the United States and the Russian Federation, I very firmly believe that we have a responsibility to make sure that the Security Council continues to be an effective body dealing with various international issues.
Ambassador, we have seen during President Trump's campaign his willingness to reset ties with Russia, to make it ties better. Now that he's sworn in as president, we see somewhat different statements, not from him, he's been consistent, but from members of his National Security Council, from General Mattis, from Nikki Haley herself. Her first speech in the UN was rather critical of Russia, if we think about it. Do you think there will be some kind of resistance between Trump and his people?
Well, first of all, I think a number of our senior officials, including Sergei Lavrov, made it clear that we're not expecting miracles. We understand that we have a very complicated agenda on our hands in our bilateral relations, in the role our countries are playing in the world. So their team needs to take shape. Of course, this meeting I had with Nikki Haley was a very, very small step in establishing contacts among our teams. I think the upcoming meeting, I understand that even this month in February, within maybe a few days, Sergei Lavrov, our foreign minister, is going to meet with Rex Tillerson, the new Secretary of State of the United States, and that would really be the first significant contact between our two countries, and that will, I think, shed more light on what the Trump administration is prepared for right now. But also, one has to be remembered that we have a long stretch ahead of us. So so the first contact will be important, but maybe will not reveal much in terms of how far we will be prepared on both sides to go in dealing with various international subjects. So we need to have some patience, and we need to work professionally on those matters. So this is what is our intention.
Speaking of Rex Tillerson, he's also not a diplomat, not a professional diplomat. He's a businessman first and foremost. You've overseen a lot of changes in diplomatic structures in Washington over the years, and in New York, obviously. Do you think the fact that the Secretary of State is not a diplomat as well could be an interesting factor for you as a diplomat?
Well, interesting or not interesting, I mean, the United States has this system, I think, which is a very good system, that senior diplomats, senior businessmen, top businessmen, they show interest in international affairs as well. And my understanding is that Rex Tillerson has been involved in some of those institutions which follow in the United States, which follow international relations. And of course, he has traveled the world extensively, so he carries a lot of experience, not maybe purely in terms of international relations, but certainly he is a person who is not new to the world. And if you look at the track record of or the history of the United States, there have been a number of businessmen who were propelled to the position of Secretary of State, and they showed quite well. For instance, I was in Washington in the 80s when George Shultz was the Secretary of State during the Reagan administration, and I think he did quite well. He was a very serious and solid presence in the diplomatic life. So, I mean, I think we all wish him well, because, of course, like is the case with Nikki Haley in the Security Council in the United Nations, it's very important that the Secretary of State of the United States is an effective presence in international diplomatic life. And I have no doubt that this is going to be the case.
Rex Tillerson was actually scolded a lot by the media before he was appointed for, you know, his receiving an order from President Putin and things like that. But when he made his speech at the appointment session in the Congress, I thought personally his stance towards Russia was the most coherent. Did you have that feeling as well, that he knows what he's talking about?
Well, first of all, I watched some of it, but I didn't follow every word which was said during those hearings. After all, I have a different job here in the United Nations. Yeah, I think some things which he said showed that he had this solid personality, understanding the responsibilities of the Secretary of State of the United States, avoiding sort of big flashy statements which were probably expected of him by some of his interlocutors in the Senate. So he, I think, if I may say so, he presented himself well, and he got confirmed by the Senate. So now it's time to get down to work, which he has done already. So, you know, preparing, hopefully, thoroughly for his first meeting with Sergei Lavrov. So we'll see what's going to happen. I'm encouraged that also, of course, it's very good he's a person who is familiar with Russia. He met President Putin. This is only an asset. You know, he's very well positioned to do a good job as Secretary of State of the United States.
You were mentioning there the flashy statements. I mean, Nikki Haley's first speech in the UN could not probably be considered as flashy, but was it something that you expected that she would set
the stage? Yeah, you know, I didn't expect her to depart from the standard position, and there is a standard position of the United States on certain issues. I think that definitely the tone of her remarks was very different from what we heard before from her predecessor. And she started out by saying that she didn't want, it's not a direct quote, she didn't want sort of to spoil her relations with Russia, which I thought was a very good signal. But of course, I did not expect her in her first speech in a Security Council meeting presided over by Ukraine to depart from the sort of the standard American position. She said, we'll continue to do so and so. But you know, you and I, we know Anglo-Saxon sort of culture and history and psychology and psyche. Remember, never say never. This is one of the things which we sort of need to keep in mind. Things are evolving, so I would not be too concerned over a reiteration of the previous position.
Speaking of Ukraine, since you mentioned it, there's a lot of speculation right now in the media from every side of the border as to what's going on, the escalation of violence. Do you think that this may be a bad start for the U.S.-UN relations?
Well, actually, I think that those who are provoking those manifestations of violence in eastern Ukraine, this may be one of their goals, to make sure, because they don't want the relations between Russia and the United States to improve, to make sure that there are additional obstacles for that improvement to happen. And of course, the crisis in Ukraine is one of the things which need to be overcome for the potential of Russia-US cooperation really to be fully utilized. So this may be one of those situations, which when this is one of the goals, to make sure that it's more difficult for the United States to establish better relations with Russia.
But now also Ukraine presides over the UN Security Council until the end of the month. Is that an important factor which plays into Kyiv's hands?
It is a factor. It makes it a little bit easier for the Ukrainians to pursue their agenda in the Security Council. But I think it's very interesting to note that even though the Ukrainians convened that meeting on the 2nd of February, actually they didn't get that much support. The only support they received was from UK and from the US, but from the US in very standard, as I say, in very standard sort of language coming from the previous administration. All the other participants in the discussion, 12, Russia, of course, had its own position. They were basically saying the Minsk agreements need to be implemented and there needs to be a political settlement. And that was exactly our sort of line of argument in the Security Council. So they didn't, reap much benefit from convening that meeting and making provocative statements about Russia and about the situation in Donetsk. So I think that this is another factor which may be conducive to finding progress in settling the conflict in Ukraine. And also, recently we had this Ukrainian resolution in the General Assembly, human rights in Crimea. But that was when people were not voting about human rights in Crimea. I mean, many of those who voted did not even read this resolution. It was another test of are you sympathizing with Ukraine or are you sympathizing with Russia under the current circumstances? And to me, it was extremely significant that only 70 countries voted in support of Ukraine. If you compare to the original vote on Crimea, when the Crimea originally was reunified with Russia, it was 100 countries who were voted basically, let's face it, in support of Ukraine for a number of circumstances. I'm not going into it right now. So now I think the support of Ukraine has clearly diminished in the United Nations, and this is a very encouraging trend in terms of the pressure which needs to be put on Kyiv to make them do the things which need to be done in order to have the Minsk agreements implemented.
I find it not that I'm surprised, but it's still quite staggering that all the coverage from the media about what's going on in Ukraine these days is focused on Avdiivka, on, you know, people killed there, while they're not actually mentioning at all the situation in Donetsk, where people are also dying and bombs are falling. What is the conversation in the UN about that? I mean, are people actually paying attention to what's going on the other
side? Well, of course, here in the Security Council, people are more professional, so they sort of understand the complexities. But you're absolutely, in terms of propaganda, you're absolutely right. One has the impression that only Avdiivka is being shelled, and the fact that it comes after the tanks moved to the Avdiivka, their weapons are not supposed to be there. Now their heavy weapons are there, and they're shelling Donetsk. They have been shelling residential areas in Donetsk and Lugansk throughout the conflict on a daily basis, and not much attention is being paid to that. So this is one of the problems we have in terms of propaganda, in terms of lack of objectivity by a lot of international media in treating the situation in Ukraine. So we have to live with it. But fortunately, if you read sort of carefully, as professionals do, the reports of this OEC monitoring mission, which is working in Ukraine, even though we believe that sometimes that they could be clearer in presenting the facts, which they have, you know, you read the facts, it's obvious that it is the fault of the Ukrainians, and sometimes, of course, there are violations on the part of people from Donetsk and Lugansk, but it's clear that the recent spike of military activity was initiated by the Ukrainian armed forces and those, you know, voluntary or whatever battalions which are fighting in eastern Ukraine.
Let's move on from Ukraine at this time. The professor of Russian studies at the New York University, Stephen Cohen, recently wrote in The Nation a huge article about the new wave of detente, or razryadka as we know it in Russia. Do you think we're actually getting there? Something that started in 1969, then died in the 1980s, then came back again in Gorbachev-Reagan era. Is it detente point four?
No, I hope it might be, but it's very difficult to use those like detente or reset. I think this is going to be something new and different. Of course, I hope that we are going to advance far enough to make a difference in improving our relations. But how exactly it's going to happen, are circumstances going to intervene, which is going to make it more difficult, or on the other hand, the circumstances might force us into a closer cooperation, like this channel, like this challenge of ISIL. Is definitely, or other terrorist organizations, the challenge of terrorism is definitely one of the circumstances which is driving the need for us to cooperate. So there are too many question marks. So one might have hopes, but how exactly they are going to play out, it remains to be seen.
Speaking of terrorism, Donald Trump apparently has a very interesting, peculiar vision of terrorism, since this week he actually called Iran the terrorist state number one in the world. Russia is a very close partner with Iran. Do you think this may be some kind of a stumbling block on the way to rebuild?
Well, we have differences, of course, in a number of areas, including the understanding of the role of Iran. But, you know, Sergei Lavrov recently spelled out our attitude to this particular problem, pointing out that Iran is playing an active role in fighting ISIL. You know, the complaints about Iran mostly come out of their support of Hezbollah or the differences they have with Saudi Arabia, you know, the Shia-Sunni controversy, which is one of the most fundamental and difficult problems we have in international relations. So it's a situation which has to be viewed objectively. Also, this hue and cry about Iranian missile launches, you know, ballistic missile launches. I was surprised actually to hear even American experts speaking on like CNN describing the situation about ballistic missile launches. They're saying, well, this is a violation of bans by UN Security Council. Those bans were there before. All those bans were lifted when the arrangements on the nuclear, nuclear problem, Iranian nuclear problem were reached. And now we have a situation where the Security Council resolution, which is on the books, it says that we call upon Iran not to test ballistic missiles designed to be capable to deliver nuclear weapons. So not only it's not a prohibition, it's just a call So technically or politically or legally, you cannot argue that they are violating any kind of a prohibition. But actually, it has to be proven that this particular missile has been designed to be capable to carry a nuclear weapon. So it's not as simple as that. And in international life, of course, you have to differentiate between your emotions, what you want to see, but also what you are really sort of has the right to expect from another country. So there are, as I said, there are so many complexities and so many issues which can come, which can create additional problems, including problems which might affect, I think, our relations with the United States. That it's very hard to make sort of straight predictions as to the course of action and the course of developments from now on and looking into the future.
Could China be one of them? Trump is also not really friendly towards
Beijing. No, not really. I think, first of all, I think nobody, including us, would not like to see any deterioration of the relations between China and the United States. It would affect international life. It might affect the atmosphere in the Security Council. But their argument, as far as I can tell, is mostly in the sort of economic field. It's not exactly an area where we are having most of our relationship with the United States. But generally speaking, any deterioration of the situation among major powers is not a good thing. So definitely would not like to see that happening.
Speaking about Iran again, I mean, considering the, you know, the intensity of the statements and particularly by General Flynn and Mattis, pretty much everyone, Trump on Twitter, that was quite vehement. Do you think there's a potential for something serious there? I mean, not even in the triangle of Russia, Iran, U.S. relations, but U.S.-Iran relations. Could we see some kind of war?
I hope not. Of course, the fact that, you know, such statements are being made. Also, I want to point out that that statement by General Flynn, National Security Advisor, was caused not just by this ballistic missile launch, but also by the situation in Yemen, where they sort of suspect Iran of supporting the Houthis and, you know, being one of the drivers of this conflict, which has been there already for 2 years, an extremely bitter and bloody conflict. So that also has to be looked at. And in fact, I think that this is one of the areas where we need to cooperate more closely also with the United States and internationally in the Security Council, the settlement of a very complicated and very devastating conflict in Yemen. So, of course, there are sort of additional sources of concern, but also maybe in a perverse diplomatic way, this is an additional venue for our cooperation.
Yemen, why doesn't make as much noise as Syria used to make?
I mean, it's a forgotten conflict. It's been overshadowed by Syria, and also quite simply, the Saudis are not allowing international journalists to travel to Yemen. Until recently, there was a situation when, I mean, there are no flights into Yemen. They banned the flights into Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. Until recently, the journalists were allowed to take UN flights. But then the Saudis said no, so there is very little media presence in Yemen, and this extremely, extremely tragic conflict is being overlooked. And it has all sorts of, I mean, the humanitarian situation is a disaster. I mean, it's a country of over 20 million people, almost all of them depend on humanitarian supplies, no medical supplies, no food, very little food. They're almost entirely dependent on import of food, and because of this kind of a blockade, the effort to block the inflow of weapons, which the Saudis suspect are coming from Iran in terms of support for the Houthis, they also create all sorts of problems for regular sort of humanitarian food traffic and other humanitarian supplies. Very bitter, bloody fighting. Al-Qaeda on Arabian Peninsula is becoming more and more active there. So it's actually definitely, in terms of its fabric, maybe even more complicated than the conflict in Syria. And of course, not there in terms of maybe the number of people killed. But in terms of the sort of human suffering and humanitarian problems, it's certainly up there, maybe even more dramatic than the situation in Syria.
But why are there no Security Council resolutions?
No, there have been Security Council. There was a Security Council resolution which is not being implemented. And we have regular meetings with Ismail Ahmed, the special representative of the Secretary General. We follow things. Embassy is still there in Sana'a. Our ambassador is now in Riyadh, but he's actively participating in the sort of international diplomatic process in an effort to settle the conflict. But the two sides in the conflict come from very different positions, and it's not obvious how those positions can be reconciled. They want things which are very different, and the more they fight, the more difficult it is becoming to find common ground. This is actually one of the simple conclusions I personally have drawn watching the conflict in Syria develop and the conflict in Yemen. You know, the international community must stop those things as quickly as possible. If we allow such conflicts to drag on, then with the blood, emotions, casualties, it is becoming more and more difficult to settle them. So as soon as is politically, humanly possible, those things need to be sort of arrested and brought to normalcy. But unfortunately, both in Syria and in Yemen, we have allowed the conflicts to continue, and that has created those dramatic humanitarian and political and whatever economic consequences.
But when it comes to Syria, we have at least seen some determination and some willingness from your Western colleagues to do something, you know, to intervene, to make, you know, resolutions and things like that. But do you hear this kind of conversation on Yemen within the UN Security Council?
No, we do. I mean, we talk. It doesn't find its way to the front page very often, but we do talk about it all the time. And recently, we had Ismail Ahmed talking in consultations in the Security Council, and but unfortunately, the compromise between the parties is not obvious. At some point, several years ago, it seemed that they were very close to finding some kind of common ground. Or recently, incidentally, one of the last things Secretary John Kerry did, he came up with a proposal for kind of a formula to settle the conflict. It was rejected by President Hadi, supported by the Saudi-led coalition. I mean, so it's as I say, the two parties, the conflicting parties, they want things which are very different. And unfortunately, it is also a situation where the Saudis and, you know, the coalition they lead, they see Iran everywhere. So they are not dealing just with the Houthis, but they are concerned that if they give concessions to the Houthis, that would mean giving greater presence for Iran in Yemen, and they don't want to see that. Actually, you know, one of the greatest challenges of the for the international community, I hope, for example, that Russia and the United States together can do that, is to find a way to bring together the Saudis and Iran, you know, Shias and the Sunnis. This is one of the most dramatic and difficult controversies, of course, which goes back, I think, a millennium. But we need to find a way to make them see each other not as enemies, but as Muslims, which must live together in this world. But so far, a key to unlocking that door has not been found.
What do you think Russia and the United States can do in this regard? I mean, it does look like a very
well. We need to, you know, I think the United States shares exactly the same perception of the problem, but it's extremely difficult when one talks. I remember I was at some international gathering, you know, Chatham House, whatever, in the region actually, and one European foreign minister actually asked the panelists, and there were some Sunnis and an Iranian on the panel, said, what can we do in order to, you know, what's the problem? And they simply laughed him off. They said, you know, you need to go a millennium back in order to understand our enmity. So it's psychological, it's political, and I suppose it's very difficult for them to find a way, a balance between the ambitions of Iran, the protector of the Shias, and the safety of the monarchies in the Middle East, the Sunni monarchies. So that balance has not been found. But, you know, as you know, Russia, we have been there for a long time trying to initiate some discussion of security in the Persian Gulf. So we have tried from time to time, but we have not been successful so far. And unfortunately, it shows in a number of conflicts in Syria as well. Of course, the origins of the Syrian conflict are to a large extent the fact that it was one of the elements of the competition between the Sunnis and the Shias in the area.
And Iraq as well, yeah. But do you think it's possible at all to reconcile those two?
Well, it should be possible, because without that reconciliation, we will not find tranquility in that part of the world. What we need in the world is more tranquility, because the world has been upended, you know, and the number of bottle, you know, corks have been taken out of the bottle. We had in Libya, we had the cork taken out of the bottle, and all the problems in Africa, which were exacerbated by the crisis in Libya, by the toppling of Gaddafi, you know, ruining the Libyan state, essentially. You know, all those problems started flowing out of Africa, Northern Africa, Sahel region, etc., etc. And then another bottle was uncorked in Syria, when one of the most successful countries in that part of the world was destabilized. So another flow of problems into Europe started coming from Syria. So this is one of the very serious challenges, I think, is to find a way to bring back some degree of stability, and then we'll be able to work on the socio-economic and other problems.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.